can take the moon, gather up the stars and the robins that sing merrily. Put them in a box, tie them with a ribbon, throw them in the deep blue sea. You can take the flowers down in Lover's Lane and that sentimental poetry. Put them in a box, tie them with a ribbon, throw them in the deep blue sea. Not for me, all that stuff, the dreams that ruin your sleep. Not for me, had enough. Love is one thing you can keep. You can take the plans and the wedding bells and whoever sings or promise me. Put them in a box, tie them with a ribbon, throw them in the deep blue sea. 'Cause love and I, we don't agree. Kisses in the dark, all the promises made faithfully. Put them in a box, tie them with a ribbon, throw them in the deep blue sea. And you won't go wrong if you take a song sung by Frankie Boy or Mr. C. Put them in a box, tie them with a ribbon, throw them in the deep blue sea. Not for me, all that stuff. The girl for you, the boy for me. Put them in a box, tie with a ribbon, throw them in the deep blue sea. 'Cause love and I, we don't agree.
That was Doris Day. This is Richard Roth, and this is The Passage. My guest today is Nancy Shaver, an artist who has a shop on Lower Warren Street called Henry, full of extraordinary things. It's a kind of a visual laboratory, she calls it, for her own work as a sculptor, which is of some renown. She was awarded the Guggenheim Fellowship in 2010, Krasner Pollock Grant in 1993. She's had residencies at the Yaddo and McDowell colonies. After the interview, a minimalist piece by a young composer named Brian Samolchik, included in the Yehuda Hanani series, Close Encounters with Music, in Pittsfield this weekend, and Carl Sandburg reading one of the Rutabaga stories, how six pigeons came back to hat-track the horse after many accidents and six telegrams. And if you've never heard those, stay tuned, they're great. First, Joe Pass, The Night Has a Thousand Eyes. Thank you. I'm with Nancy Shaver here at Henry, a shop at 348 Warren Street in Hudson. Nancy,
I would like to start with a very broad question. What did you do as an artist before Henry, and how did Henry come about?
As an artist before Henry, I used a lot of the objects which are now in Henry, or objects that are sort of like what I sell at Henry in my work in the early 80s. And it was a matter of practicality. I was sort of an obsessed collector of things, and I lived in a small apartment on Sullivan Street in New York City. And a photographer at that time, and I was finding I was more interested in objects, becoming more and more interested in objects. And I began putting them on frames of pictures I was taking, and then work moves along, and collecting moves along, and I moved upstate and realized I needed a way to make a living up here other than go to Burger King and try and be a waitress. So I started trying to sell the things I was collecting, which landed me eventually in Hudson.
And that was how long ago?
I'm not quite sure. I don't keep track of dates, but I'd say 15 to 16 years ago.
Now, when you say the kind of objects that you have in your store in Henry, what does that mean? Can you explain a little bit?
They're objects that have very clear form or visual qualities, or are just ordinary things, industrial things, which I think are quite beautiful. I have no boundaries in terms of what I like to see, which makes a display sometimes challenging. I live an hour and a half northwest of here, and that's where I find most things within a 5 or an 8 hour range of where I live.
And what attracted you to Hudson originally?
It was a matter of practicality. I live in an incredibly rural area, and there was no way for me to make a living. And Hudson was becoming known as an antique center, and designers were known to come to the city to look at things. And it seemed like a logical place to try and sell the things I'm interested in.
At that time, when you first came, you were at another location.
Yes. I had been selling things at flea markets and antique shows, and it was incredibly strenuous and difficult. So I got 4 friends together, and we formed a shop called Fern, which is still in Hudson and run by my friend Carol Peachum. I quit Fern after 2 or 3 years because I was finding a need to control the visuals of the shop more and more. I didn't want to share. I wanted my own shop. So I moved down to 348, which was the lower end of town and did not have much commerce going on. And David Cremoni rented the space to me.
At that time, David had a rug shop next door, is that
no,
right?
No, he had just closed it.
I see.
About that time.
So this goes back then to about the mid-90s?
I think I opened Henry in 1999.
And things come and go all the time.
Yes, things evolve all the time. And Henry changes over time. And often I look around and think, oh my goodness, because in some ways Henry sort of changes actually with the cycle of my work. I've become more and more interested in color, and I find that Henry is more and more colorful. And it's always surprising to me when I see the relationship between Henry and, you know, my artwork so strongly.
Now, when you are in Hudson, that's Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, normally, mm-hmm. and then you go back upstate and work in your studio?
Yes.
And what sort of work are you doing right now? Is there anything that you could describe it in kind of...
Yes, I'll describe the process for you. Probably 6 months ago, I discovered a source for Japanese fabrics, pretty much from the mid-century. Henry has been headed toward more and more towards textiles, and I was delighted to find these fabrics. And part of the whole was a whole bunch of bolts of red fabric, of red silk lining for kimono, and the color was sort of absolutely spectacular. And it was the combination of color, the feel of the silk, felt so much like what I like to have from color. And then the second time I went back, I bought some kimono that were handmade, hand-dyed, and sort of spectacular patterns and color, which were boggling to me because they were so bright. And I couldn't imagine a culture where people wore this much color. And the color was so clearly related to landscape, or translating landscape into textile. At that point, I bought these bright kimono, and I started taking them apart. And taking them apart made me even more conscious, perhaps, of the history of Japanese color, which is based in some way much more than ours on color and texture and pattern and form. And then at that point, it occurred to me that I wanted to try to use these kimono as handmade, beautiful things with all of this history of, in fact, practical art, or art we're not, pretty much don't value because of our culture is based probably just on money. And so then I started using them in my block sculptures and trying to contrast them against a bunch of ordinary fabrics I've started using, which are plaids and flannels and just Walmart textured material for ordinary people.
How long have you been involved in this particular work?
I'd say a year and a half, or maybe a little longer. Again, it's just evolved over time with the things that I use.
And when you say your block, what you're saying is you're wrapping these blocks in these
yes.
these different fabrics. Now, were you a teacher at one point?
I have patched together a living out of the different aspects of I guess, my love of art. And at this point, I'm teaching in the Bard MFA program, the Milton Avery School of the Arts. And it's a summer program, and I usually teach 4 or 5 weeks in the summer.
I see. And what are you teaching, basically?
I'm part of the sculpture faculty.
How many students would normally be in one of your classes?
They're not classes per se. They're individual meetings with students to talk about the work. And the program usually has about 80 students, maybe a little less, in all kinds of disciplines. And basically, you just have meetings with all of these people.
With all the people in the program?
Yes.
I see.
From music to photography to video, painting and sculpture. I'm probably forgetting some.
When you were doing photography, what were you doing?
Actually, it was the same sort of subject matter. I think I've always been interested in what I would call the vernacular. And my own work, in fact, what I would describe as my own work began as a series of pictures of children's T-shirts and the kind of logos that we all place on children's T-shirts. And then this was in the 70s. And
at that time, you were still living in New York City?
At that time, I was living in Middlebury, Vermont. That work occurred mostly in Vermont.
And you're a native from upstate New York, I think.
Yes. My family grew up in western New York near Buffalo. Again, a very rural area. The town was called Appleton. It's basically nothing more than a crossroads.
And as a kid, what were you doing?
Like I say, it was very rural, and there wasn't much to do. I think I always had an interest in art making, and it grew through high school. And I applied to Pratt Institute and got in. And I basically wanted to go to New York City more than anything. And I was fortunate to be let into Pratt.
Actually, Bob Wilson said that getting into Pratt wasn't quite as important as being in New York, as far as he was concerned.
Yes, exactly.
And so when was that you were at Pratt?
I was at Pratt, I believe, 64, probably to 68 or something like that. It took me a year longer because I entered into the interior design program, which after a year was not for me, and I transferred to the art program.
Now, as far as interiors go, you have a book called Henry, which shows some
Henry
of the...
Henry at Home, actually.
Henry at Home. I'm sorry, Henry at Home. That shows some of the objects in people's homes. Could you talk a little bit about that?
That book came out of an idea for a catalog for a show that took place, I think it was in 2007 at Feature Gallery. And the idea of that was an intertwining of Henry objects and my own artwork. And the catalog, it was supposed to be a catalog for that show, but it did not come into fruition until a number of years later when a student of mine who knew Henry called and asked if she could make a book about Henry. And so that's what I wanted to do most, was show how objects had moved from Henry to other people's homes. And I actually think the things in people's homes, they look much better than they do in Henry. And it's a great pleasure to go see them in other people's houses.
Did you take the photographs?
I took most of the photographs. And then sometimes or I took a share of them, but lots of times I asked the people whose homes the things were in to take pictures for me.
Now, do you have your devotees, as it were, people who...
I do have a clientele, but it seems to be completely changing all the time because people change what they're interested in and because their houses get filled up and they don't want any more. So I'm always looking for new clientele. And, you know, I never know whose imagination will strike a fancy here.
You said earlier that you, right now, you were particularly interested in color and we're doing more color in the shop. So...
It's color comes mostly through textiles at Henry at the moment. And it's anything from polyester quilts to a few Navajo rugs, but mostly hooked rugs. I've become very interested in hook rugs, which were made in the U.S. probably from the late 1800s, maybe through the 60s even, and with remnants and rags from coats and outerwear, which women cut up laboriously into strips and then wove in and out of canvas backing and created designs, and designs were made for hook rugs. Women who wanted to do hook rug could also buy kits.
And some of them were kits and some of them were just invented at home.
Yeah.
And what this, I suppose, was this canvas was something they could go down and buy at the store.
Lots of times it was burlap, so I'm sure burlap was just available. I'm imagining women in farm communities making these mostly.
How do they actually do that? Do they stretch it across a frame?
I believe so. I'm not quite that sure, a frame or not. And then there's a needle, and it just punches the wool in and out of the holes in the canvas.
Something like a crochet hook or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And those, are you able to kind of spot the date from the rug itself?
In fact, I'm not much of a researcher. I learn what I know about a thing, which is in most cases sort of minimally, from looking at it, and I can sort of tell basically what age a rug has been done in by looking at it, more or less.
Now, you were saying that these were American rugs.
I think so. I think the technique was brought from England probably much earlier than that.
And that's something that is exists in some abundance?
I believe so. There are just some very high in auctions, and it's a historical fact, like quilts, and they have a history and a history of their being collected, and museums like the Craft Museum in New York probably have some of the best collections of the most astonishing rugs.
Now, occasionally you find something that you just can't part with?
Mostly not. From being a collector and understanding how weighted down one becomes if you're a collector, and the difficulty as you get older of being a collector makes me very happy to have the shop not be a collector, pass things on, and to have the continual excitement of looking for something out, something which I've never given any visual weight to, which I can begin looking for. more seriously.
When did you become a collector, would you say? At what age? I mean, was something from your early age?
Yes, I would have always liked to be a collector. As a child, I collected bright candy wrappers. But my family was not very much into objects at all, so it was not possible as a child to be much of a collector. When I was 18, I went to Pratt, and that allowed me to begin my life as a collector. I had a roommate named Melody Del Sandro, and she and her mother, turns out, were avid flea market shoppers, and so connection with Melody made it possible to have adventures looking at flea markets and buying things.
Now, you also would go look at things with Walker Evans, I believe.
Right. After Pratt, I was living and actually married Haim Steinbach, and we moved to New Haven as he went there for graduate school. And I showed work to Walker Evans, and he allowed me to sit in on his class, and it turned out we had similar interest in things, and we went out collecting objects. Basically, I was sort of his assistant in collecting objects, looking at objects and finding objects.
Now, why was he collecting these objects? To put in photographs?
No. He was an avid collector and had piles of things, and he was interested in the, again, visual, sort of the way age showed up on ordinary things. Crushed. He had a collection of crushed cans that were run over by cars and so on, and things like that.
Huh, how interesting. You were saying when I first came in that you were rearranging things. Do you get the urge to rearrange fairly often, or how does that work?
Yeah, I think it's important to rearrange things, because when they're rearranged, new aspects of the same objects become visible. And because I can't be buying all the time and I can't be storing the things that I bought for Henry, it's very important that they look different and fresh.
Do you go through periods when certain things kind of, a certain kind of thing begins to catch your eye?
Yeah, like I said, textiles are becoming much more interesting to me lately. And since they're sort of easier to deal with than furniture, I become, again, thinking more about having more a predominance of textiles at Henry.
Now, these Japanese silks, you may have said, but what period are they from?
They're basically from the 50s.
Oh yes. Mm-hmm.
And so they were. What's so remarkable is even in the 50s, the Japanese culture was so based on the handmade that these, I imagine, they're for, you know, middle class people. These kimonos are all handmade, and then the silk is hand dyed. Its saturation of color is pretty amazing.
Do you have any art shows coming up planned?
I'm going to be in a show that opens in June, curated by Matthew Higgs, and it's called, I think it's something like Abstraction in Everyday, Everyday in Abstraction, something like that. So it will be probably one of the block pieces, which I use fabric and paint on.
And where will that show be?
I think it's going to be at James Cone Gallery in Chelsea.
And you have shown in Hudson also?
Yes, I have shown with John Davis, just up on the corner.
When you've been in the shop for 3 days, are you anxious to get back to the studio and vice versa?
Well, that's interesting. It all depends on sort of what has happened, I guess, in the shop. Sometimes I get so involved here, both with sort of the pleasure of selling the things that I like and with rearranging, that it is a little hard to go home. And then the other is true as well. When I'm at home in my studio and have to come to Henry, sometimes I'm not so happy about it.
It can be very nice to stay home.
Yeah, I like being in my studio. I like working.
Now, did you build a studio, or did you find something that was already there?
Yes, I married John Jackson about 10 years ago, who's a sculptor and makes things out of old tools. And I moved to his house because he had built it, and it was harder for him to move than me. And we built my studio off the back of his house.
And in your studio, I guess you have your, at the moment, you have your silks kind of spread out to choose, or your fabrics of various kinds.
Well, I'm a messy worker, so it's quite a hodgepodge of whatever I'm working on. I don't mind. I like messes. I find accidents are the way, I guess, my way to making art.
Something kind of shows up together and,
yeah,
and you like that.
Yeah, whatever happens.
And how long do you spend on a piece? Do you work continuously on one piece at a time?
I work on several things at a time. They can take a long time, like a couple of years, or usually it's like a month, 2 months, 3 months, something like that. And a lot of it is just sitting in my chair and looking at it and trying to decide what the next thing is that needs to be done. And then I like to have them in the studio to make sure that there's nothing else I want to do with them. So there's a lot of time involved in just looking.
I can't think of anything else to ask you right now. So,
uh-huh. Well, that sounds good. Well, I think I'll open up and see what happens on this Monday.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
How six pigeons came back to Hatrack the horse after many accidents and six telegrams. Six crooked ladders stood against the front of the shanty where Hatrack the horse lived. Yellow roses all on fire were climbing up and down the ladders, up and down in crossways. Whiffle the chick sat there early in the summer, enjoying herself, sitting on a cracker box, listening to the yellow roses climb around the six crooked ladders. Hatrack the horse came out, on his shoulders two pigeons, on his hands two pigeons. And he reached his hand around behind his back where his hat was hanging, and he opened the hat and showed Whiffle the chick two pigeons in the hat. And Whiffle the chick said, "They're lovely pigeons to look at, and their eyes are full of lessons to learn. Maybe you will tell me why you have their feet wrapped in bandages, hospital liniment bandages full of hospital liniment smells. Why do you put soft mittens on the feet of these pigeons so lovely to look at?" And he answered, "They came back yesterday, came back home, limping on their feet, with the toes turned in so far they nearly turned backwards. When they put their bleeding feet in my hands, one by one, each one, it was like each one was writing his name in my hand with red ink." And Whiffle asked, "Did you know they were coming?" "Every day the last 6 days I get a telegram. Six telegrams from six pigeons, and at last they come home. And ever since they come home, they are telling me they come because they love Hatrack the horse and the yellow climbing roses climbing over the six crooked ladders." And Whiffle asked, "Did you name your pigeons with names?" "These three, the sandy and golden brown, all named themselves by where they came from. This is Chickamauga, here is Chattanooga, and this is Chattahoochee. And the other three all got their names from me when I was feeling high and easy. This is Blue Mist. Here is Bubbles. And last of all, take a look at Wednesday evening in the twilight and the gloaming." "Do you always call her Wednesday evening in the twilight and the gloaming?" "Not when I am making coffee for breakfast. If I am making coffee for breakfast, then I just call her Wednesday evening." "Didn't you tie the mittens on her feet extra special nice?" "Yes, she is an extra special nice pigeon. She cries for pity when she wants pity, and she shuts her eyes when she doesn't want to look at you. And if you look deep in her eyes when her eyes are open, you will see lights there, exactly like the lights on the pastures and the meadows when the mist is drifting on a Wednesday evening just between the twilight and the gloaming. A week ago yesterday they all went away, and they won't tell why they went away. Somebody clipped their wings, cut off their flying feathers so they couldn't fly, and they won't tell why. They were 600 miles from home, but they won't tell me how they counted the 600 miles. 100 miles a day they walked, 600 miles in a week, and they sent a telegram to me every day. One writing a telegram one day, and another writing a telegram the next day. All the time walking 100 miles a day with their toes turned in like pigeon toes turned in. Do you wonder they needed bandages, hospital liniment bandages on their feet, and soft mittens? Do you wonder?" "Oh," said Whiffle the chick, "show me the telegrams they sent you. One for every day, for the 6 days while they are walking 600 miles on their pigeon toes. Show me." So Hatrack the horse got the six telegrams. The reading on the telegrams was like this. First, "Feet are as good as wings if you have to. Signed, Chickamauga. Two, if you love to go somewhere, it's easy to walk. Signed, Chattanooga. Third, In the night sleeping, you forget whether you have wings or feet or neither. Signed, Chattahoochee. Fourth, what are toes for if they don't point to what you want? Signed, Blue Mist. Fifth, anybody can walk hundreds of miles putting one foot ahead of the other. Signed, Bubbles. Sixth, pity me, far is far, near is near, and there is no place like home when the yellow roses climb up the ladders and sing in the early summer. Pity me. Signed, Wednesday evening in the twilight and the gloaming. And Whiffle asked, did they have any accidents going 600 miles walking with their little pigeon toes turned in? And Hatrack said, once they had an accident, saying it with Chattahoochee standing in his hat, Chickamauga on his right shoulder, Chattanooga on his left, and holding Blue Mist and Bubbles on his wrists. They came to an old wooden bridge. Chattahoochee and Wednesday evening both cried out, the bridge will fall if we all walk on it at the same time. But they were all six already on the bridge. The bridge began sagging and tumbled them all into the river. But it was good for them all to have a foot bath for their feet, Wednesday evening explained. Whiffle spoke up, I got a suspicion you like Wednesday evening in the twilight and the gloaming best of all. Well, said Hatrack, Wednesday evening was the only one I noticed making any mention of the yellow roses in her telegram. And then he picked up Wednesday evening and reached her around and put her to perch on the shoulder bone on his back. Then the old man and the girl sat on the cracker box, saying nothing, only listening to the yellow roses all on fire with early summer, climbing up the crooked ladders, up and down and crossways. Some of them leaning out and curving and nearly falling.